Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is reporter George Nixon. And coming up, the pandemic has proved fertile breeding ground for scammers, but whether you get your money back from your bank can be something of a lottery. Will new rules being proposed change all that? Also today, how much significance should we put in Tesla buying over £1 billion of Bitcoin? Is this a sign that big business is getting on board with crypto, or just a one-off? Plus, with tips on where to go for investing inspiration, a victory over child trust funds of disabled children, and the ultimate piggy bank, Budum. Britain's first agricultural bank in 100 years launches with competitive saving deals to help British farmers. But is it any good? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a quick word about the state of the economy. We got GDP figures out this week. It's not great, not going to lie. But really, could it have been any other way? And overall, the economy contracted 9.9% last year, more than twice as much as the previous largest annual fall on record. But every cloud, not as bad as some economists had been expecting. No double dip recession. And apparently we're going to bounce back like coiled springs once the lockdown is over. Simon, so how bad is this? And are we going to bounce back like a coiled spring?
Good question. I'll answer the last one first, because if we think back to November and the Bank of England's inflation report and interest rate decision, where they give their outlook for the economy, we were gonna bounce back now. This was it. We were bouncing back now, on the proviso that the November lockdown finished when it was meant to finish, and the November lockdown did finish when it was meant to finish. They were predicting growth for the first quarter of the year. Unfortunately, we had another lockdown, so it's probably not going to be growth for the first quarter of the year. But the good news is that we have avoided a double dip recession, as you said, because a double dip recession would be going back into recession. We went into recession last year when lockdown initially came in. And the thought was that the economy was going to shrink in the final quarter of 2020. And then the lockdown that we're in the middle of now, which, let's face it, is pretty strict, probably not as strict as the first lockdown was initially, but pretty strict and looking to be pretty lengthy, is going to shrink the economy as well. So we would have gone back into recession, two recessions in fairly swift succession, known as the double dip. But the economy grew by 1% in the final quarter of 2020. It surprised everyone. So what went on there? Well, I think you need to take into account the 3 months, obviously. So you've got October, you've got November, you've got December. October, stuff was being tightened. What did we get? The rule of six in September. Then we started to get more rules on where you could go, what you could do at pubs and things like that. There was talk that there was maybe going to be a lockdown in the half term, but that didn't happen. But the north, the tiers that were affecting the north and severely restricting business there were going on. But October may be okay. November, we went into lockdown. Non-essential shops were again closed and so on. But I think that the economy, and I think this is the interesting thing about this, is it's a sign that the economy has found a way to get round the widespread closure of a lot of businesses. Now, that's not particularly helpful if you run a pub, a restaurant, or a shop that's shut. However, what has happened is enough of those businesses and other businesses have found a way to still do enough business to sell enough stuff to people that they've avoided the shrinkage that we got first time round when everybody went, okay, what do we do now? And scrambled to work things out. And then we've got December. December's probably what saved it, because in all reality, we came out of lockdown in early December, and then London, and I'm talking about London as being important here because London has a huge chunk of the nation's population, more than 10% of the nation's population. London went into the strictest tier four restrictions just before Christmas, but it was close enough to Christmas that I think anybody who was going to be out doing Christmas stuff had probably done it in early December. And again, there was talk that there was a big wave of Christmas present buying and stuff like that from people, and from people going, well, you know, we haven't been able to do anything this year. Some people had their lockdown savings. Let's spend some money. Let's treat ourselves. Let's treat the grandkids. Let's treat the kids. There would have been a lot of kids this year who got big presents, because it's like, if we're going to buy them a big present, let's buy them a big present this year. I mean, I did exactly this. I did exactly that with my children. They wanted a Nintendo Switch. Under normal circumstances, would we have bought it for them? We were like, let's just buy it for them. What's going to happen now is the big question, because GDP figures just look backwards, don't they? It's difficult to know. There's a part of me that thinks maybe the fact that we did manage to grow by 1% in the final quarter of last year might mean that we might just about eke out a really minuscule amount of growth in the first 3 months of this year, because people are largely working from home if they can. If you can't work from home, a lot of people are still going to work. I feel awful for the pubs and the restaurants and the shops that are shut. And I feel awful for the pubs and the restaurants and the shops that are shut and are never going to reopen, because there's going to be quite a big chunk of those. And the people's hopes and dreams and, you know, finances that that represents. But I do think maybe we might just eke out a tiny bit of growth. Overall, output shrunk by 9.9% in 2020, according to the ONS. That is the worst since records began in 1955 and thought to be the deepest downturn since 1709, when the Great Frost descended across Europe and caused the UK economy to shrink by an estimated 13.4%. I love how precise that figure is, considering it was the Great Frost of 1709 and actually really our contraction is the worst since records began in 1955. Yet we can sort of work out what happened in 1709. A year that I can only presume was substantially colder than it has been this week.
Mm-hmm. I just like to talk of the Great Frost. So I should have pointed out that was Andy Haldane, by the way, the chief economist for the Bank of England, who talked there about a coiled spring. George, what are your thoughts? You're the optimistic side?
Not hugely, okay. Not least because you talk about economic growth, obviously it's all relative. What we're doing is basically climbing slowly out of an enormous hole that we found ourselves in. As at the end of 2020, the economy is nearly a tenth smaller than it was at the start of the year. And there's all this talk about growth. We're not actually, the economy's not actually growing. The big challenge is, because economic growth was stagnant pre-pandemic anyway, is what you do afterwards to this whole Build Back Better phenomenon, which basically the government's plan is entailing building lots of wind turbines, I think. Yeah, not hugely optimistic, because also the Bank of England has suggested that only about 5% of those lockdown savings could be spent. I mean, Andy Haldane's been on the more optimistic side of things anyway. He was saying that we were in the middle of a V-shaped recovery in the middle of August, I think. So we'll see.
I should say that my optimism for the first quarter of the year is not shared by a number of economists who know more about this than I do. So Samuel Toombs, who's an economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said that he thinks the economy has started 2021 on a very weak footing. I'm quoting him here, and they're looking for a 5% month-to-month decline in GDP in January and a 3.5% quarter-on-quarter drop in the first quarter as a whole. So we'd have to reverse the economists' suggested 3.5% drop to a 0% or slightly more than 0% increase in order for me to be right.
Mm-hmm.
So just to qualify reality, that.
You're always going to find opinions from every different angle on this, because there is no one answer. We literally do not know what's going to happen.
I think what's holding us back probably this quarter, and what's going to be an issue, is that A, we don't have Christmas, which helped us out in the last one.
That's true.
B, it's not, the weather's not, it's cold, it's winter. Everyone's hunkering down. It's harder to spend money. People were splashing out on hot tub, bring back the hot tub subject, yeah. You know, but this was a phenomenon. People were splashing out on anything they could possibly splash out on. The weather was good. The evenings were light. It was warm. They wanted to get out and have a good time. Last spring to summer. I mean, the real concern actually is that it is the fact that the UK, out of major economies, has suffered the biggest decline of GDP. So we've seen the 9.9% drop. We've had a worse drop than Italy. That's 8.9%. France, 8.3%. Germany, 5.8%. Canada, 5.5%. Japan, 5%. The US, 3.5%. overall the world is about 3.7, and the Eurozone average, I guess, which is the kind of thing we should be comparing ourselves to, it was 6.8%. So we are doing worse. And the question is, why are we doing worse? And it's because our economy is so heavily consumer dependent. And if you lock the consumer up, you have a problem. China, of course, where this started, saw GDP growth of 2.3% last year. But China, you can't compare GDP in this country or Europe to China, because China's GDP is of a magnitude in terms of growth to any of the developed Western world, because it is still, you know, it seems crazy to talk about China as developing, but it is still in economic terms considered to be developing.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother debate for another day. But you say we're consumer-led, and you're absolutely right. Most of the things that we could have bought, office equipment, gym equipment, hot tubs and stuff, we've sort of done it now. Are we not hopeful of getting out? However, it was saying that if we had a year to forget, we're going to have a recovery to remember, because we're all going to go out and buy Hermes scarves. Isn't that what they did in China?
Yes. But you just reminded me of something when you said that, which I think is a really important point. Actually, one of the problems is that we did go out and spend on all those things that you were talking about: garden furniture, home office chairs, desks, and stuff like that. It's actually really quite difficult to get your hands on a lot of that stuff at the moment. A lot of things that people want to buy like that are sold out, or they're waiting for them to come back into stock. So I think that might cause an issue, perhaps, in that people want to be spending, and actually even the stuff that they do want to be spending on from home, they may be struggling to buy right now.
Maybe. I'm kind of thinking there's an optimism about the vaccine, that people are wondering whether, do I buy this office equipment when I could be going back to work? And if you've not needed it over the past year, you're probably unlikely to need stuff like that. But garden furniture, you never know. But anyway, we'll move on from this, because we could talk for ages on it. But I was talking the other day and saying, you know, in a pandemic, there are no winners. But I think I was wrong, you know, because there are. And we've seen that over the past couple of weeks with some of the figures out about scammers. Yes, they are the winners, because scams, cons, all that sort of thing have skyrocketed during the pandemic. Criminals taking advantage of our fears, our uncertainty, the fact we're all online, working from home. Some of the most common have been con emails about the government's financial help schemes, pension liberation, dating fraud, investing scams. Bank transfer scams cost Britain £207.8 million in the first 6 months of 2020. But whether you get your money back from the bank can be something of a lottery. But that might be about to change. George, just give us an overview. Just the scale of fraud, financial fraud, bank transfers, online, all those sorts of things in this country.
As you've just mentioned, Georgie, the scale of fraud is absolutely huge. There were 57,000 cases of fraud losing £207.8 million, as you said, and that's just the first half of last year. Those sums will probably be bigger in the second half, because that's what happened in 2019. And these figures, what's known as APP fraud or push payment fraud, is basically where people send money directly to fraudsters. This covers, as you say, investment scams involving huge sums of money, to online shopping scams involving an average of about 729 quid, which is still a decent chunk of money. This is not people mucking around on Reddit. This has been linked to serious international terrorism, serious criminal activity. This is really high, I don't want to say high quality, but you know what I mean, stuff. So yes, the scale is absolutely enormous.
And actually, some of those figures you said there are bank transfers. This doesn't include lots of other different types of frauds and scams out there. I mean, it is huge, and it costs, you know, probably untold billions, for the fact that there's still a real sort of embarrassment around it, isn't it? People just aren't reporting it because they feel, I've done something wrong. And actually, when you see the stats here that, you know, 43% actually got their money back from the banks, you might think, well, I'm not going to get my money back anyway, so why bother? What are the reasons that banks are giving for not giving you your money back?
So you mentioned that 43% figure. That's the average reimbursement rate since a new anti-fraud code, which said that, except in certain exceptional circumstances, victims of APP fraud should get their money back. So, which means that 57% of the time they're not getting that. But these figures vary hugely between banks. Some banks refund on a higher basis. Some refund as little as 1% of the time. problem is we don't know which ones because they won't tell us. We'll get onto that in a little bit. The reasons. Firstly, banks are very quick to insist that this is not the full picture. But again, not that they give us that full picture, of course, but they say, you know, they can recover more sums from criminal bank accounts, plenty of fraud is stopped, etc., etc. So they insist that these raw reimbursement rates aren't the full picture. In terms of the reasons they give, it's largely around customers being negligent, which is one of the exceptions in the code as to why you can, why victims shouldn't be reimbursed, or ignoring banks' fraud warnings. Although, again, it's questionable how effective those warnings actually are. There's been plenty of reviews which have found those warnings are not always that effective.
So what are the proposals? You teed us up there. We know that we don't know what percentage really banks are giving money back, but that could soon change.
Yeah, so if you go on to the story we wrote about this on Thursday, these are proposals from the payment systems regulator. We have a nice pretty chart which shows the reimbursement rates of 9 banks. Now, these banks are named A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and I. Won't tell us because it's commercially sensitive, but there are several proposals proposed by the PSR, one of which, and the most high-profile one that we led with, is this idea that reimbursement rates could be publicised. So those banks, instead of being unnamed, could say, this is Barclays' reimbursement rate, this is Lloyd's reimbursement rate. I think this is a very good and long overdue idea, and I can't really think of any good or serious proposals against it. Other news organisations have actually sent FOI requests to banks and regulators in a bid to try and get them to disclose the figures, which again has not worked. I think it's really important because you can compare banks' credit card offerings, current account offerings, personal loan offerings, but you can't compare how likely they are to give you your money back if you have, for reasons that aren't your fault, lost your life savings to an incredibly sophisticated scam. Mm-hmm. That seems very, very strange. There are some other incredibly interesting proposals in the PSR as well, which, without getting too into the weeds, would be putting what's essentially a voluntary code signed by 9 banks into the architecture of the UK payment system. So if you pay for something by card or you pay for something by direct debit, there are certain guarantees and protections that you have against fraud, right? That is not the case with bank transfers at the moment. And under some of these proposals, which run until the 8th of April, banks could be required to reimburse the fraud victims in a similar way. And also this would mean that more banks would be covered because there's currently only the 9. In terms of whether these would change anything, how useful, how substantive they would be, I mean, I don't know. I don't think, especially the naming and shaming, as it were, can hurt. But there are so many issues around funding fraud reimbursement at the moment, and the way in which scams are also prevented in the first place from actually happening, which obviously is the important thing. So banks I speak to are exasperated by the way in which they are expected to bear the biggest load of this and how little interest the likes tech platforms like Facebook and Snapchat have in preventing fraud on their platforms, which banks say is where most of this online fraud actually starts. So none of this stuff will work on its own. However, a lot of these proposals are both the ones that are consumer facing in terms of publishing reimbursement rates, and the more kind of structural change I think is really welcome and long overdue, to be honest.
I know I'm looking to switch banks at the moment. It would make a difference to me if I could see these sorts of figures. But to play devil's advocate a little bit, Simon, you know, in your experience, one, how likely are we to get this sort of data, these sort of changes that are being proposed? And two, is there not an argument from banks, and George outlined that very well there, that actually a lot of it's got nothing to do with them. It's these other third-party platforms, and oftentimes it is our own error, perhaps judgment errors, or we're not taking as much consideration over. Yeah, I'm not blaming people for fraud. The only people who are to be blamed are the criminals. They're the ones to blame. But, you know, actually banks could say, look, because people are careless, quote, or these sort of measures may encourage people to become more careless, why should banks foot the bill? And therefore, if banks are footing the bill, it means all of us are footing the bill, surely.
I think there is an element of truth to that suggestion from the banks. I think that ultimately what's going on here are cons. People are being conned by fraudsters, con men, con women, you know, and the way that you do that is you deliver a convincing story, and for whatever reason, whatever lever you pull, probably one of two, either greed or fear, because those are the two most powerful levers to pull, you convince someone to transfer some money to where they shouldn't be transferring the money to. The bank will argue, well, ultimately you can't hold us responsible for that because you transferred the money. Someone else conned you and you fell for it. You transferred the money. There's been a lot of work put into warning people not to do that. There's been some work put into getting people their money back when it's happened, because if, for example, someone steals your bank details off you and you haven't been negligent, you'll get your money back. People have felt that people should get their money back. Arguably, at the start of this, and this is why This Is Money has been campaigning on this for years and initially started campaigning on it, banks weren't doing enough to warn people. And we got this feeling, the suspicion that banks were sort of conveniently sweeping it under the carpet, because a lot of this was going on with people phoning up, pretending to be someone's bank and so on and so on. Now your bank will have a warning now saying they won't phone you up and warn you to move money to a safe account and all those other things. The fraudsters come up with more convincing stories and than that one. You know, maybe people don't fall for that one anymore. So the fraudster comes up with another story. Ultimately, though, whilst you can't hold the banks responsible, they are facilitating this. And if you can't stop people conning people, which you can't, because conning people is as old as time, then you need to make it harder for the con to take place. And the reason why there's been such a massive rise in these kinds of fraud is because it's so easy to send someone money. Now, I'm not arguing for 1 minute that we make it much harder to send people money, because we all like being able to send people money very easily. And you know, we'd get very grumpy. We get grumpy for the two-factor authentication makes a lot of people grumpy. Mm. So what can we do? The warnings, maybe the warnings aren't obvious enough, still flashed up when you transfer the money. Maybe the print is still too small. Maybe, you know, you might get a warning on that payment screen, but do you get literally an interstitial page? That's a page that flashes up between one page and another that says, you know, have you checked this out? What are you doing? The fact that this money goes, it has to go somewhere. It has to be transferred to an account. And then when it lands in that account, often it then just bounces off to lots of different places, and the banks say, well, we can't go after it. They struggle to go after it. Maybe there needs to be more onus put on banks to follow the money, you know, as they say, and to try and crack down on it that way. Because ultimately, you should be able to work out where the money's gone and then try to get the money back. And the problem is that people, they're defrauded and they complain, and the bank doesn't. Ultimately, they find it difficult to get the money back because it's been transferred into lots of other bank accounts and so on, but the person who's complained just doesn't really get any help. And that's why so many of them end up coming to us or rival publications and saying, look, I've been scammed and the bank's not helping me. And then I think the banks have a responsibility in terms of where some of the stuff around these cons is coming from. You know, there's still people phoning up and pretending to be your bank. Right. But if your bank does phone you up, they phone you up and they say, hi, I'm so-and-so calling from X bank. I just need to take you through security first. And then they ask you security questions. And it's like, well, you phone me. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I know I'm me. Okay. How do you prove who you are? And they never can prove it. They might offer you some kind of bit of information that you could find out, but you say, well, look, you could find out. You could, if you were a relatively smart fraudster, you could find out that piece of information. So how do you prove it's you? And maybe we need some kind of the banks to set their bright minds to sitting and thinking of some way that you solve this problem and then communicate it widely, because I think that is still a genuine issue. And I don't know. I mean, you're never going to solve it entirely. Maybe it is unfair to say to the banks they have to refund every single penny of this when people have ultimately been conned and they're just the middlemen. But I do still think that the banks could do more on it. And I would like to see more. And we will continue to campaign for more to be done.
Good. I'd agree with that. All right. Well, Bitcoin is back in the headlines this week after its value hit another record. It comes after Elon Musk's electric car company, Tesla, revealed it had invested $1.5 billion in the cryptocurrency and said customers would soon be able to buy its vehicles with Bitcoin. Its value has now soared by 372% in the last year to over $45,000 and remains way out in front of other cryptocurrencies, other digital currencies. Simon, why did Tesla do it?
Because Elon Musk.
Okay, fair enough. Why did Elon Musk do it?
Because Elon's been like playing crypto puppet master for the last few weeks. I don't know what's got into Elon. It's like he's a pretty busy guy, you'd think. Like, you know, turning Tesla into an all-conquering electric car, battery storage, future of energy company, and sending stuff into space. Yet still he finds time to sit there and do a bit of crypto tweeting. So this is very interesting, okay? Tesla said that it is going to take some of its money and it is going to put it into Bitcoin. What money? Is the first question you should ask. So it's the money that it doesn't need, money that it doesn't need. I've always had a problem with this, like your spare money. Nobody has spare money. But basically, in a filing with US authorities, Tesla said it changed its investment policy to provide us with more flexibility to further diversify and maximize returns on our cash that is not required to maintain adequate operating liquidity. So basically, Tesla has a cash pile, okay? And Tesla has to work out what to do with this cash pile, and it has decided to sink $1.5 billion of it, which is a lot of money, into Bitcoin. Now, Tesla thinks its Bitcoin holdings are highly liquid, i.e., if it needs to get the money, it could flog the Bitcoin, but did admit that digital currency prices can become very volatile, which is maybe downplaying it, and so it could hurt them if it needs to be liquidated. There is an entirely plausible scenario where Tesla's $1.5 billion becomes worth $750 million in a relatively short space of time. And if it needs that other $750 million for some reason, it's going to have a bit of an issue. Now, this isn't the money it needs to operate on a day-to-day basis. So if you were to compare Tesla's balance sheet to our household finances, which is always a dangerous game to making those kinds of comparisons, this is not the money that you need for your food shopping or to put petrol in your car. It's more like your savings pot that you've got. But maybe you've sat down and looked at it and gone, I've got way too much of this savings pot in cash and it's not really doing anything and I want to put it to a more constructive use. So I'm going to invest some of my savings pot whilst leaving myself enough on one side to fix the clutch on my car if it goes, or repair my boiler, or cover myself if I lose my job. Whether Tesla has successfully done that remains to be seen, but it certainly set the cat amongst pigeons and sent the Bitcoin price soaring yet again. So we've had a number of ATHs, all-time highs this week. And now, then we had some Twitter.
It's $47,500, I've just checked now. Yeah. It is.
We had Twitter making noises about it as well. I mean, it continues Bitcoin's stratospheric rise. Now, what's interesting is whether more big companies are going to follow suit. I don't know whether your like average Joe company is going to follow suit, but what about the big tech companies? Twitter, you know, there's talk Twitter was making a few noises about it. What about Apple? What about Google, or Alphabet as it's known as? What about Facebook? What if they decide to put a small amount of the cash that they've got into cryptocurrency? It makes a difference because they've got a lot of cash and there's not a lot of cryptocurrency. You know, Tesla's Bitcoin investment represents quite a sizable chunk when in reality of Bitcoin compared to what it represents as a sizable chunk of all the dollars, the US dollars in the world. That would shift cryptocurrency upwards. That's why the price is going up. That's why people are buying in. There are a couple of investment companies that own sizable chunks. It's one called MicroStrategy. Ruffer Investment Trust put 3% into Bitcoin, although actually that didn't all go into Bitcoin. Some of it went into like Bitcoin correlated assets. So it's almost like a play on Bitcoin because it's quite difficult to actually buy such big chunks of Bitcoin because there's just not that much of it and the market isn't that liquid. But, you know, when Ruffer did it, it said it was looking for an uncorrelated asset. Is Bitcoin a totally uncorrelated asset to the world's frothiest stock market, the US market, of which Tesla is among the world's frothiest stocks? Do we see a scenario where Tesla's share price takes a pummeling and Bitcoin takes a pummeling at the same time? I don't buy this Bitcoin's an uncorrelated asset argument. I think Bitcoin is sentiment for Bitcoin is really quite strongly correlated to the sentiment for, you know, bullish stock market trading and investment. That's not to say that it's not worth having a bit. I've got a bit just in case it does turn out to be, you know, the future as it stands. The question that people now ask themselves, you know, from a personal investing point of view, is it too late to buy it? Has it gone up by too much? It keeps hitting those all-time highs, but people ask that question at $10,000. They asked it at $20,000. It fell recently after hitting that over 40,000 high back to $30,000. There were a lot of people who were saying, I'm going to wait till it gets back to 20 and then I'll buy. And then it went all the way from 30 up to nearly 50. It's always dangerous buying into something when it's near the top. You have to believe that the institutional money is going to keep and the corporate money is going to keep moving into it and drive the price up. And ultimately, you could be right. You could be wrong.
So in sum...
In sum, you need to think about all of these things and then make a decision as to whether you think you've missed the chance, whether you've still got a chance, or whether you're just not interested in Bitcoin and you're going to invest your money into something that is a more productive asset. And by productive asset, I mean that Bitcoin doesn't produce anything, just like gold doesn't produce anything. Warren Buffett, famously on gold, you know, you can bury all of the gold in a square smaller than a baseball field, and when you dig it back up in however many years' time, it will still be the same amount of gold. Whereas if you put your money into a company that can turn cash into productive means, it will grow its profits over time and you will be rewarded for it. But maybe it's good to have a bit of your money in something like a gold or Bitcoin or something. It's personal choice.
I just want to ask about the wider cryptocurrency market, because Bitcoin is way, way out in front. And the argument that we're investing in the technology and what Bitcoin can do doesn't seem to be borne out in the fact that then Bitcoin is the one that is so far ahead of all the others. What do you think, just briefly, Simon, is going to be the impact on the wider cryptocurrency market? Or is Bitcoin, I mean, who knows, really? God, who knows? But is that the one?
So we did a really good article on this a while back. Maybe it was January time or before Christmas. I can't remember. I think it was January time on the other cryptocurrencies, kind of focused on Ethereum and some of the others and this whole DeFi, D-E-F-I world. People who know more about cryptocurrency than me tell me that Ethereum and Ether is the better one in reality in terms of usage. I know myself that Bitcoin isn't the most flexible and usable of cryptocurrencies, but Bitcoin is the one that everybody knows of and it's the big name. And maybe there's an argument that the one that's going to have the greatest chance of being the most robust store of value is that one, in the same way that gold is a more robust store of value than silver or platinum, you know. Mm-hmm. So the other cryptocurrencies are up by a lot as well. I mean, Elon's been sending the price of Dogecoin up into the sky by repeatedly tweeting things about it and memes about it. And Dogecoin started as a bit of a joke.
Okay, well, if you are finding chat about Bitcoin is crowding out some of perhaps the more interesting, nuanced conversations about where one should be investing, then worry not, because this is money you've been looking at. Some of the best sources of inspiration for where to put your money and naturally some of the worst. So Simon, where do you get your investing inspiration from? Obviously these chats.
Well, I've got a real problem because I can't just get it from some bloke down the pub now who tells me I'm going to make loads of money on this idea that he heard about from a mate of his. It's a real pain. I wonder how many people have actually managed to save money off the back of not punting money into something their mate down the pub told them about.
They're all going on r/WallStreetBets instead.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the great irony is if there was ever a year to make some quick money off stuff that your mate down the pub told you about. It would have been the past year. But there are good places to go. Look, investment ideas, you know, it's an important thing. Where are you going to get them from? And there's a lot of different places. There are some places that are possibly better to go than other places. But there's also things that you observe in your everyday life. So there's this idea of this thing called scuttlebutt, right? Okay. Keeping your eyes open, your ears to the ground, looking at the world around you, seeing what's doing well. Now, we live in a consumer economy. A lot of the companies you can buy into have some form of consumer relationship, whether that's supplying businesses that then sell to you or whether it is businesses that directly sell to you. And you can see if they're doing well. You can see what they're doing. Now, we spoke to Sophie Lund-Yates at Hargreaves Lansdown. She used the example of Next and said, a perceptive investor will have noticed early on that Next was fast to react to the shift to online shopping. Its history as a mail order catalog company meant it had a lot of the infrastructure already in place. Those that were already ordering clothes from the group's directory could have put two and two together to realize Next was in a perfect position to beat its peers to the World Wide Web. I would give another example in the clothing stakes, Boohoo. You could have observed that Boohoo appeared to be doing very, very well. And the thing that alerted me to Boohoo and why it might be worth buying some Boohoo shares, which I did some time ago, a long time ago, and they are the best performing share I've ever bought in my life, was that it started heavily advertising on the tube. And they're pretty cute, the people in charge of Boohoo, in terms of what they do. And I realized that they must be selling more stuff and doing well, because if they weren't selling more stuff and doing well, they wouldn't be doing the advertising on the tube. And that as long as they kept doing the advertising on the tube, it was an indicator to me that this company was doing pretty well and was probably going to continue to beat expectations. The other thing I'd say about Next is the thing that people may or may not have noticed, and this happened quite a few years ago, so we're probably going back at least a decade here, okay, is Next was one of the first shops to start disappearing from your local high street, but opening up in out-of-town parks instead, in out-of-town retail parks. There used to be a Next on Kensington High Street near our office. It closed ages ago. There used to be a Next on most high streets. A lot of them closed and they went to the out-of-town retail parks. Next, now, it's a shame, to be honest, for the high street that there isn't still a Next there, because it'd be much better if there was shops that would draw people to high streets rather than out-of-town retail parks. But the fact of the matter is that people want to go to out-of-town retail parks. They don't want to go to high streets. And the shops that remained on the high street struggled because of it. I think, for example, if you were going to take maybe some of the Arcadia brands, the Topshops and things, if they'd have jumped ship for the retail parks earlier, they'd have done better. Maybe Marks and Spencer's still on the high street. You know, I love the fact that Marks and Spencer is still on a lot of high streets. But maybe if it had jumped ship for the retail parks, it would have done better. So you could have got ahead of the curve on that. Another place that you can look at is economic cycles. You know, what's going on in the world? Are things going bad or are things going good? Are things going to pick up? Look at this, you know, this year and the last year. Things absolutely tanked. So normally you'd go for defensive stuff. What's defensive stuff? It's the people that, stuff that people are always going to have to buy or the places people are always going to have to go to. Often oil is considered relatively defensive, but everybody was told to stay at home, so they weren't going to use any oil, were they? But the supermarkets, on the other hand, people were going to have to keep buying food from the supermarket. So the supermarkets kind of did quite well. But then what turned out to be defensive and people didn't really think was going to be defensive was those big tech stocks, those big US tech stars. Everybody thought they were just going to get totally knocked off their perch. But actually, if you thought about it properly, telling everybody that they weren't allowed to go out and they had to stay at home all around the world was only going to be good for stuff to do with the internet. And so people didn't quite grasp that they actually turned out to be maybe more defensive than they would be. Now it's looking ahead. It's when are we going to get out of this? When are we going to be allowed out? When are we going to be able to spend some money? People bought in the vaccine rally, saying, you know, like, okay, let's buy the oil companies, buy the holiday companies, buy the airlines. And then things went south again, and then we were all stuck at home. You know, people could be looking at that kind of thing. Another thing is you know, the big themes, what's changing the world for the better, the shift into green technology. Governments want to do this. They're going to throw huge amounts of money at this. Who's going to be expected to do the work? private enterprise. Watch the experts, what are fund managers doing, what are investing experts talking about, read the articles, read everything with a pinch of salt, talk to others. What are other investors doing? You know, there's chat rooms, you know, joking aside, you know, people, there are very engaged investors in chat rooms who like to talk about stuff. What are people talking about on social media? Join some of the sort of investment society type things that there are. There's ShareSoc, the Share Society. There's all kinds of, if you go out looking for it, there's all kinds of stuff. There's an event called Mellow, which is really popular with share investors. And it's really great. They get loads of people from companies to talk and investors to talk. Maybe you might want to run the numbers on the data. For example, you might want to do a stock screen. You can do some of that for free, but you can go to websites that you pay for, such as Stockopedia, which is one that Mrs. Money recommends, where there's huge amounts of data. Watch what directors are doing. Are they buying? Are they not buying? And then also be skeptical. You know, stuff that you see on an online forum, anything that some self-styled guru tells you, anything that you read anywhere, a tip from your mate down the pub. Never, ever, ever invest if someone cold calls you, okay? But with this other stuff, might not be bad, might be quite good. You might be getting in early. Someone might be sharing some good information with you. But always, always, always do your own research, because, and don't just rely on one thing. Don't just rely on the tip down the pub, or the stock screen, or because one expert said it, because it's your money that you're investing, so you are responsible for it.
Indeed, Simon, thank you very much. Now, there's been a major victory for parents of as many as 4 in 5 disabled children who are currently unable to access their child trust fund savings. It looked like they may have to go to court to access their money. Now, George, you've been looking into this. Give us some context. Just lay out the situation for us.
Of course. So in September 2020, children born between 2002 and 2011 began to get access to child trust funds. These were long-term savings accounts that were set up by Gordon Brown and the Labour government, the last Labour government in 2005. These are things that I'm sure many of our financially savvy listeners are well aware of if they've got kids. I, as someone born in 1997, am slightly too old to have been given one, which is a bit sad. However, this, what has been called the big child trust fund bonanza, is not the case for up to between 150,000 and potentially as many as 200,000 youngsters who won't be able to access that cash because of the disabilities they have, both mental and physical. These leave them without what is known as the mental capacity to manage money. So because of the rules of both the accounts and 2005 legislation, the Mental Capacity Act, designed to protect disabled youngsters from financial abuse, they can't touch it, and their parents or guardians can't touch it either, so this money is locked away. The only route previously open in the situation is through a court known as the Court of Protection, in which parents or guardians have to apply to become what is known as a deputy. This is a what is known as a higher level kind of authorization than an appointee, which is a parent who is allowed by the DWP to manage a disabled child's benefits on their behalf. There is a colossal irony here in that disabled children were given more money by the last Labour government into their child trust funds because they were disabled, but because of the rules, because of those disabilities, they can't actually get access to that money. It's a kind of grim irony that people have previously noted. This court process can cost a lot of money, which in many cases is more than the value of the average CTF, which is around £2,000, that money can be eaten away by court fees, application fees, which can cost about £365, plus solicitors' fees, other costs, and pages upon pages of forms, as many as 47. In fact, there have been some estimates that as much as £107 million of child trust fund cash could be lost, simply due to the fact that the process is so burdensome that 1 in 4 parents could just give up because they think it's just so much effort and time that there just isn't any point in doing it. What has changed now, fortunately, is these are proposals that there's a what is basically an alternative process that has been devised by the industry, the savings industry, coming up with this by itself. These proposals were handed to the government last September, were published, made public last December, and have now been greenlit largely by the majority of child trust fund providers. These also apply to junior ISAs in theory, which are beset by the same problems. The junior ISA, of course, was the success of the Child Trust Fund in 2011. This alternative route, which has basically been authorised by many of the largest, is open to many of the largest players, customers of many of the largest players, including One Family and Nationwide Building Society, among others, is largely for savers with less than £5,000 in the bank. At face value, it could cover 4 and 5 balances, because 4 and 5 balances are lower than that amount. And essentially, you can read the full proposals on This Is Money, because we've written about this before, and we've boxed them out in previous stories. It's basically a way of simplifying the process, which goes through providers rather than the courts. So it cuts down the costs, cuts down on the form filling. So two of the major things. It basically entails a 7-page process, 5-page application process, rather than a 47-page one, and just needs a medical practitioner to fill in another page. The only issue with this is that the government, despite being handled these proposals last September and then being made public since last December, still hasn't officially told providers that these proposals are officially legal, which is consistently proving a bugbear. They've sort of said, we're not saying that you can't do it, but we're also not going to say that you can't, that you officially can do it. So only this Thursday, the government minister was questioned in the House of Lords by peers about why it's not given the official backing to this scheme, which has been backed by the majority of providers. And he said it's not for the Ministry of Justice to give its blessing to what he called private sector schemes. Trust fund providers, I speak to, they just want clarity.
Yeah.
They just want clarity.
All right, we'll wait and see. Finally, Britain's first bank in 100 years to lend money solely to farmers has opened its door to everyday savers. But are the deals any good? George, who are Oxbury Bank and what are they doing?
Georgie, it's been largely some good news for savers in the savings market this week, which has not always been the case in recent time with record low rates. And such good news can be summed up as follows. There has been something old. Marcus by Goldman Sachs has reopened its easy access account to savers after closing it since last June. There is something new, Oxbury Bank. There is something borrowed, savers cash, and something moo in the bank that lends dairy farmers. There we go. Oxbury Bank, so in the same week that we've had the savings arm of an American investment bank reopen its cash, reopen its accounts to savers, we have a bank that is pledging to use every penny to back British farmers after Brexit. This is Oxbury Bank. It is based in Cheshire. It claims to be Britain's first solely agricultural lender since 1928. I did ask the co-founder and the chief customer officer, Timothy Coates, earlier this week why such a bank should exist, why we need a bank solely for farming businesses. And largely it's because farming is a different business, basically. It is a business with what he described as a lot of lumpy cash flow, and you need bespoke products for farmers. He said agricultural lending, like other lending elsewhere, really is dominated by the big four banks. But if you've got, this is what he said, if you've got a bank like Lloyds, then agricultural lending, although big in cash terms, is a relatively small proportion of its balance sheet. And he said it's harder to develop bespoke products for farmers if you're not that specialised. So this is the niche that Oxbury wants to fill. The rates are good. New banks and smaller banks are basically savers' sole hope at the moment, because rates are so low. Big banks are absolutely awash with cash that they don't need to pay savers for it. So what you have is new banks that come along like Oxbury, which, because they need capital, they need money from savers to lend, and they need to develop that name recognition and a customer base, they come in with some quite attractive rates. So it's got a 95-day notice account, which pays 0.58% compared to the Best Buy rate of 0.65%. And it's got a range of 1 to 5 year fixed rate bonds that are also very competitive as well. So it's been some good news for savers this week. And if you like the idea of backing British farmers, then there's a bank for you now.
Well, I personally think that if you are going to make a decision on where to put your money and where to earn a return on your savings, if the, in all reality, the actual re- difference in the return that you're going to be getting between Bank A and Bank B or Building Society C is relatively minimal, then you should think about where the money's going and who you're giving it to. And I think that supporting British farmers is an excellent idea. It's pretty hard to be a farmer. It's pretty hard to get into farming in particular. It's very hard to buy land. Unfortunately, the price of land has been bid up by large landowners. In some places, they've totally cornered the market. Some rural areas, large landowners have pretty much cornered the market in farmland, and it's very controversial. But it's tough, you know, and you need someone who understands the finances of farming, as George was saying. You need someone who understands how lending you a sizable sum, maybe you're borrowing more than $1 million to buy a farm or some more land or something like that, and how that's going to play out and the nuances of that. And so if it comes down to the difference of making an extra 25 quid a year on your savings, then yeah, why not give your money to someone supporting that kind of thing?
I must say it's been an incredibly fun story to research, because not every day do you come across a bank which has as its lending criteria a minimum requirement of 100 cows or 250 acres. It's been great writing the puns for as well.
I was going to say, and you did ultimate, a marvellous little...
The ultimate. Yeah. The ultimate. Lee Boyce and I have had a great time with it. The ultimate piggy bank, watch your savings grow, cash cow.
If you want to understand a little bit more about the economics of farming and the challenges faced by people, I highly recommend a book called English Pastoral, written by James Rebanks, who is a Lake District sheep farmer.
And if you have any comments or questions for the team, because that is it for this week, you can keep up with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any recommendations on farming books, if you have any more puns that you can give us related to banking and farming, or anything that you'd seriously like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to see podcast past and join in the debate and read comments. And to anybody who emailed us or tweeted us or left us a comment in the comments about the Investing Mistakes podcast that we talked about last week, don't worry, we will feature those. It's not this week, but we will feature them in a week to come.
Well, indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.